Proverbs chapter 6. In order to get the setting for Proverbs chapter 6, we need to read the last words of Proverbs chapter 5, because they provide the setting for everything in the sixth chapter. The fifth chapter, the last verse, reads, "He will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray." Go astray is a word in Hebrew that simply means to reel. So in his folly, he will reel. And then chapter 6, with the image of a man reeling through life. The idea is he has no goals. He never gets anywhere. He stumbles through life. And with the image of a man stumbling through life, we come to chapter 6, which are concrete examples of doing just that. And the concrete examples are four. When we talk about folly, by the way, the man in chapter 6 that stumbles through life in his folly, the idea of folly is any course of action that doesn't come to a good end. It doesn't have to be sinful. All sinful action is also folly because it doesn't come to a good end. It can also be just stupid action. And one of the first examples we will get in 6, 1 through 5 is somebody who has co-signed for another person. And he's not going to label that as sin, but it's folly, simply because it will come to no good end. And therefore, the examples of folly in Proverbs chapter 6 are four. Number one, we have in chapter 6, verses 1 through 5, the folly of the cosigner. 6, 1 through 5. Someone who agrees to back up or guarantee the financial obligation of another person. That's folly. And the idea of folly is he's taking a course of action, though you may not label it as sin, it is certainly an action that comes to no good end. The second is the folly of the sluggard. 6:6-11 See, these are all concrete examples of what chapter 5 ended with, which is this man is reeling through life. And here is the example of a man reeling through life in a concrete way. And the first one is the cosigner, the second one is the sluggard. Incidentally, we said last week in teaching through Proverbs that we are going to put all of these character sketches into a booklet. And I did the first one this week. And what was the one that I was sure to get out of the way and done first? I had to do the sluggard first. And then we did the ideal woman. So we'll be pulling all of these character sketches together, hopefully very soon. Third, down in verse 12, it says, "A worthless person, a wicked man, is one who walks with a false mouth." And this will point out the folly of the troublemaker. The best way to explain this man is he is a troublemaker. And the troublemaker is talked about in 6:12 through 15. 12 through 19, 6:12 through 19. And then fourth, and occupying probably the largest portion of the chapter, in 6:20 through 35, is the folly of immorality. 6:20 through 35. And so probably today we will follow and get in our study the following things. We will look at the folly of the cosigner, and go straight through the text of 6, 1 through 5. And then we will develop a little bit about how the righteous develop, what their view is of money. And we will look at three things. We will look at how the righteous view money, what their viewpoint is on it. We will look at the way they gain money. And then third, we will look at the way they use money. And then next, saying we have time, we will look at the sluggard in 6, 6 through 11, and then also in the rest of the book of Proverbs. So we're ready to begin with our first point today, which is going to be the folly of the cosigner, Roman numeral number 1. Folly of the cosigner. 6, 1 through 5. And first things we will have in 6, 1 and 2 is his financial blunder is going to be explained to us. What did he do financially that was so unwise? And we'll simply have in these verses, financial blunder explained, 6, 1, and 2. and then we will have financial blunder corrected, 6:3 through 5. First of all, it is explained. The assumption of these verses is that the person addressed has made a horrible financial blunder, and he needs to get himself out of it. So we begin with the explanation of it. Chapter 6, verse 1. My son, if you have become surety. Now there, in nutshell, is the mistake. The man involved here has become surety. And realizing that the expression become surety may be something that we do not understand in English, we want to explain it from two angles. Number one, we want to give an example of it. And number two, we want to give a definition of it. First of all, an example. The example comes out of Genesis 43. Genesis chapter 43 is an example of going surety. Genesis 43. The sons of Jacob have been down to Egypt to get food, and they have returned, and they have again run out of food. And so in verse 3, Judah spoke to them, saying, "This man solemnly warned us," that is the Pharaoh of Egypt, "you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you." They had not taken Benjamin. And as a result of not taking Benjamin, Joseph has said, "You cannot come back again unless you bring your brother with you." And so, verse 4, "If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food," speaking to Jacob. "But if you do not send him, you will not go down, for the man said to us, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.'" In other words, Joseph has been very clear, unless Benjamin comes along, you have no chance of gaining any food. So, verse 6, "Then Israel," or Jacob, "said, 'Why do you treat me so badly by telling me the man whether you still had another brother?' But they said, 'The man questioned us, particularly about us and our relatives, saying, Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' So we answered his questions. Could we possibly know that he would say, 'Bring your own brother down'? And Judah said to his father Israel, 'Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, we as well as you and our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him.'" And there is the key idea of going surety. He is simply saying, "If you'll send Benjamin, I will be surety." That means that if something happens to Benjamin, I'll be responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and send him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever. So he's simply saying, "Give me Benjamin to take down, to display to Joseph so we can get food. And if anything happens to Benjamin, I will be fully responsible for him." And therefore, the example of going surety simply means that someone is saying, "Look, you have incurred an obligation, and I will be responsible for it." And therefore, coming back to our definition, is surety is a guarantee in case of default. It is a guarantee in case of default. If something happens to Benjamin, hold me responsible. And this is simply saying in verse 1, if you've gotten into a situation where if someone else defaults financially, can't make their payment, you will pick it up. And in the context, it's not simply a matter of someone not meeting a payment and you say, "Well, I'll have mercy on you, or I'll be good to you, or I'll loan you the money." The idea is, if they do not pay, you are legally responsible. So it is becoming legally responsible for someone else's default, or as we would put it in English, you have co-signed. Simply meaning that if the other person does not meet their debt, you are personally responsible for the debt. So reading on in Proverbs chapter 6. "My son, if you have become a guarantee for your neighbor's debt, if you have co-signed for him, if you have given a pledge..." Actually, the Hebrew is very vivid at this point. It says, "if you have struck hands." And the idea of striking hands means you have legally agreed, very much like our shaking hands. So if you have struck hands, made an agreement for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth, and that refers to the verbal agreement. And notice the idea here, you've got the word, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth. If you have been caught with the words of your mouth. The idea of being snared or caught would imply that this person got talked into it. He got a snow job, and the other person, by means of clever words has gotten you involved financially. In other words, they set you down, they perhaps begged with you, they pleaded with you, they had a sad story to tell you, or perhaps they indicated that if you will go this route and co-sign, there'll be enormous benefit for you. This is a deal you just can't turn down. It's a sure thing. Of course, every deal is a sure thing. It's a sure thing you can't miss. Look at all of the evidence. This thing is going to go. All we need is a little money up front. And you fall for that. And so the idea is you have been the victim of a snow job in this context. And therefore, you have now something about the financial blunder corrected. The financial blunder corrected. What ought you try to do? And his emphasis is you make every move possible to get out of it. 6, 3 through 5. And so the correction begins with point one, is take steps to free yourself. Get out of it if you can. And that gets a double emphasis on take steps to free yourself, because two times we have the word deliver. First of all, in verse 3, and second in verse 5. First of all, verse 3. Do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. Verse 5. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand. So the emphasis is double deliver. Do everything you can to get out of this. Double emphasis on deliver yourself. You're in trouble. Recognize it. Do everything you can to get out of it. In other words, this is simply saying there is a place to try to correct bad decisions you have made. It is not inappropriate to say, I've made a decision, it was a bad one, I'll have to live with it. It is a first step to say, I made a bad decision, is there anything I can do to free myself from it? And we ought to recognize at that point that when we make bad decisions, that's the first thing to ask. When we recognize that, look, this decision was unwise, it was a bad one. And when we make bad decisions, we've got to face one of two things. Number one, we may be bound by it. We may simply have to say, I've got to live with it. But this passage is saying, look, your first approach is not to sit back and say, well, I made a decision, I've got to live with it. The first step is to say, I made a decision, and I'm going to try to get out of it if it is possible. And an important point right at this point is when you see this man in chapter 6 trying to get out of a bad decision, does that strike you as having a problem? If so, what? What would the problem be with it? He's made an agreement. He's co-signed. He said, I'll back you up. Now the author is saying, get out of it if you can. Does that give you any kind of problem as a Christian? What's the problem? You're probably saying, are you not? Well, look, didn't he give his word? Didn't he say, I'll do it? And isn't he now backing out of an agreement? But nonetheless, the context, I take it, is saying, look, if you have made a bad decision, it is legitimate to go back and admit to yourself, I made a bad decision, and say to that person, it was unwise, is there any way I can negotiate out of this? And that is not, in the light of this passage, a dishonest thing. And therefore, apparently in chapter 6, only a person who was absolutely rigid would say that, well, you've given your word, you've got to stick with it. This allows for the fact that a person may make a bad decision. And from the standpoint of people making agreements with it, ought we not to say, look, if a person comes to us and said, look, I agreed to do such and such for you, I will keep my word. However, I regret the decision. And I would like to change if you will be agreeable to it. How would you respond to that? Ought not we respond by saying, well, if you have made a bad decision, do you really want to hold a person to a bad decision? And in this passage, the reasonableness of is involved here of having some flexibility. So take steps to free yourself. It's not saying violate your word. It is saying if you can get from that other person an agreement, attempt to do it if you can. Okay, now in so doing, you have to do something. You have to be prepared for humiliation. And when you say to a person, I made a lousy decision, I was really unwise, that requires some humility. And notice in chapter 6 and verse 3, you have the following words. It says, do this, my son, and deliver yourself. Since you have come into the hand of your neighbor, go, humble yourself. And that word humble is very strong. It is a word in Hebrew that means to trample on. A strong word. And so he is saying in the verse, go, trample on yourself. In other words, I recognize that this is humiliating. And it is to recognize that you have made an agreement, come later to recognize my agreement was very foolish and it was very stupid. And that would be a humiliating thing to do, but he says be prepared for the emotional aspect of this type thing. Don't be afraid to trample on yourself. In other words, your personal dignity has to be set aside sometimes to settle financial affairs. And I think of no area where personal dignity can be more involved than in that. When you're in the grocery store line and you're writing a check and someone is standing behind you and you enter in your register, if you do that, and you enter in your register the amount of the check, do you hide it or do you let the person behind you know what's in your bank account? There's a sensitivity, is there not? You don't want, you shield it. You turn the check up so it's like this, and they don't see that you what is in your bank account. And it's a matter of dignity that we develop in regard to financial matters. And he simply says in this passage, don't let your dignity get in the way of straightening things out. If you need to admit that I am a financial disaster, admit it. Be willing to be trampled on in order to correct financial situations. And the implication is that your pride could very easily hold you back from admitting I'm in real financial trouble. Very, very good advice, very sound advice. All right, next is another be prepared. Be prepared for humiliation. Be prepared, second, for a strong argument. Be prepared for a strong argument. And that is in chapter 6 also, and verse 3, the last sentence, it says, go humble yourself and importune. The word importune is a word, you know what the lexicon gives for that, the Hebrew dictionary? It says, to act stormily. And our translation has given us importune, which is a strong word in English. So it's the idea for strong, vehement, stormy argumentation. So importune your neighbor or argue strongly with your neighbor. The idea is every conceivable argument that is possible, don't hesitate to bring it to the surface. And then fourth, in getting this corrected, do not delay. Do it immediately. And the do not delay is in verses 4 and 5. And it's very vivid. He's simply saying if you are in a financial mess, don't even go to bed tonight without straightening it out. So verse 4, do not give sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. In other words, this is a top priority item. And then the illustration of it is vivid. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand, and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. In other words, like an animal, when it senses the danger of being shot by the hunter, it immediately takes action to preserve itself. So this, again, then, is the folly of the cosigner in a concrete way. Interesting throughout Proverbs, it doesn't hesitate to look us in the eye and say, you're a fool, here's the way out. Or to say, you don't have any sense, correct it. Or to say, you're a sluggard, stop it. And you have inevitably in Proverbs, for all of these very, very clear definitions of character, you always have a way out. Now let's develop from this point on a topic, and that will be following off of the subject matter of chapter 6, 1 through 5, how do the righteous handle money? How the righteous handles money. and we will do scattered passages under three headings. Number one, his view of it. And we will have 3 points here. His view of it, his gain of it, and finally, his use of it. And this will be a subject study throughout Proverbs on how the righteous handles money. All right, number one, how does he view it? Number one, he recognizes it cannot meet his spiritual needs. This is the way he views it. It cannot meet his spiritual needs. It can handle tangible needs, but it cannot meet spiritual needs. Now, in looking at that, let's go to Proverbs. Well, no, in doing it, before we go to it, let's review once again the kinds of Proverbs, because we're going to have a unique kind coming up. And remember, the kinds of Proverbs are three. We have Proverbs of contrast. We have Proverbs of completion. And we have Proverbs of comparison. And as soon as we get those down, let's look at each one. Proverbs of contrast, Proverbs of completion, and Proverbs of comparison. There are different ways of getting wisdom communicated to us. And under each one of these, we will want to learn what is the key word to distinguish between these three proverbs, and an example of each. The first one in the Proverbs of contrast, the key word is but. Example, chapter 14. Chapter 14, our Proverbs of contrast. These are different ways that God has of communicating to us wisdom, or different ways he has of teaching us. And one of them is by giving proverbs that set up a contrast. And the key word is the word but. Chapter 14 has a string of them. It says, beginning with verse 1, "The wise woman builds her house." Now that by itself conveys something, doesn't it? And you could stop there and say, as the text does, that a woman who is wise is one who is positive. She builds her house. But a more effective way of teaching that would be tell what a wise woman does and then contrast that with someone who is not wise. And that would be what we have in Proverbs 1, or 14, verse 1. The wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. Verse 2. He who walks in his uprightness fears the Lord, but he who is crooked in his ways despises him. Verse 3. And the mouth of the foolish is a rod for his back, but the lips of the wise will preserve them. So notice you have teaching by means of contrast, which is saying, here is the way you ought to go, but some don't go that way, and here is the result of it. Proverbs of contrast. Second, you have Proverbs of completion. And the Proverbs of completion are recognized by the word and the word so. And so. For example, just in front of us, down at verse 13 in chapter 14. 14:13. The idea is you start a thought, and then with the word so or the word and, you complete the thought. So it's the idea of you tell a little bit, and then you tell more. And that's one way of teaching, by telling a little bit, then telling more. Chapter 14, verse 13. Even in laughter, the heart may be in pain, and the end of grief, of joy, may be grief. So notice the idea is he cuts off a little bit of wisdom, and then he extends it and gives you a little more wisdom. Look at chapter 12, verse 28. It's another one of that sort. 12:28. Think of it this way. Think of truth as a hot dog. And in a completion Proverbs, he cuts off half of the hot dog and hands it to you. And you've got something. And then he hands you the second half of the hot dog. OK? Okay, 12:28. Here's the first half. In the way of righteousness is life. Now let me give you more. And, or plus, or to complete it, in its pathway there is no death. So the idea is a move toward truth in two steps. Step one gives you the first half of it, and then he completes with the second half of it. And that is a characteristic of this type of Proverbs. The other is your like, your comparison, and that is found in the like so Proverbs. And it's where he sets up a contrast with like so or a better than statement. A like so or a better than. It's getting an operation done by a certain statement. And it is a like so statement or a better than statement that gets this across. Look at chapter 25, verse 25. An effective means of teaching is by comparison. And here's what we have here, Proverbs 25, verse 25. Notice it is a comparison. It is like cold water to a weary soul, so, comparison, is good news from a distant land. And therefore it sets up the teaching by means of giving you an analogy or a comparison. Across the page at 26, 1 and 2. Like snow in summer and like rain in harvest, so is honor not fitting for a fool. Verse 2, like a sparrow in its flitting, like a swallow in its flying, so a curse without cause does not alight. By the way, what is the key to understanding a proverb of comparison? You've got to understand the thing he compares it with, and therefore, when we had in verse 25 of 25, like cold water. You got an image? Can you picture vividly in your own mind the time that you were extremely hot and extremely thirsty and you got a cold drink of water? How refreshing that is. Well, once you set up that, then you understand what he's trying to teach. That's like good news from a distant land. Or like snow in summer. Snow in summer. Can you imagine walking out today and find it snowing? You'd be shocked. We're a little bit late summer, but with this hot winter, can you imagine the forecast as you're sitting in 105 degrees one evening will be? Shortly after midnight, there will be heavy snow warnings in Kansas City. And you say, hey, no, not in July. It can't happen. And therefore, that's what he wants us to think. You see, that's like giving a fool honor. It's completely inappropriate in its context. And therefore, you have the three kinds of Proverbs. Now, let's go back to where we were, which was in Proverbs 15 and verse 16. And we're looking at the way the righteous views money. And we're looking at 15:16, noting that it cannot meet spiritual needs. And our first passage to substantiate that idea is Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 16. And the first thing I would ask you to look at is what kind of proverb is it? How is God trying to teach us here? Well, notice this is a proverb of comparison. And he says, better is little, and the context would dictate little in terms of material things. Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. So the emphasis in the first part is it's better to have little materially than spiritual priority. So the idea would be spiritual priority, and certainly the fear of the Lord is the spiritual priority. Spiritual priority is superior to money. If you have an option of having a lot of money and no spiritual priorities, it is better to have the spiritual priority. Then in the latter part of verse 16, it says, it is better to have the spiritual priority than great treasure and, focus on this word, turmoil. And again, if you look at the word turmoil, we have in the context money plus the word turmoil. And the word turmoil, give you a straight lexical definition, mental disquietude. Mental disquietude. In 1 Samuel 14, the word turmoil is translated very great confusion. So verse 16, better is a little materially with spiritual priorities, that is the fear of the Lord and respect for His authority, than to have great material possession coupled with very great confusion. Or, as one author put it very well, it is talking about wealth with worry. Wealth with worry. Emphasis on priority. And what is he simply saying? By the way, you got three possibilities here. You could have spiritual priority and no money. Or you could, and that's fine. You could have lots of money without spiritual priority, and that's bad. Which of those would you pick? Or would you like a third? It is possible to have a third, to have both the wealth and the spiritual priorities, both. But if it's a matter of choosing, is what he is talking about in the context. Ideally, it would be nice to have all of them. That's a very difficult thing. So the first idea, then, is it cannot meet spiritual needs. And our supporting passage is Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 16. All right. Second is a recognition that neither can money meet our spiritual needs. It cannot meet emotional needs. It cannot meet emotional needs. And for that, we'll go to Proverbs 15 and verse 17. And notice the context here is the idea of emotional needs. Proverbs 15 and verse 17. It says, better is a dish of vegetables. And the dish of vegetables points to a sparse meal. Better is a very sparse meal where love is than a fattened ox. And that contrasts the sparse meal with the big meal, the luxurious meal. A fattened ox and hatred with it. And so the picture involved is here you have the right emotional setting, you have love and a can of sardines. Love and a can of sardines is better than prime rib and contention. And it is interesting, is it not, that so easily in life, if you can recall your early years of marriage, you may have had some very, very sparse meals where there was love. And see over the years the income increase, and now you can put prime rib on the table, but nobody can digest it because everybody's so angry at everybody else. You know, it lumps in your stomach, and it won't digest. It doesn't taste good because you're not getting along. And that's what he's simply saying is, look, the money has supplied the great meal. The only thing is you've lost the emotional aspect, and you can buy the expensive thing on the menu. And yet, being able to buy the most expensive thing on the menu really doesn't digest too well because the emotional setting is not right. All right, third. A lot of wisdom in Proverbs. Number three, it cannot supersede our moral needs. Cannot supersede our moral needs. And by that I mean, morality is better than having great riches. Chapter 16 and verse 8. 16:8. Better is a little with righteousness. Notice the morality of righteousness. Than great income with injustice. By the way, the word income there is a word used consistently in the book of Proverbs for dishonest gain. Look, for example, at 10:16. It's used for the money of the unrighteous. 10:16. It says, the wages of the righteous is life. The income of the wicked, punishment. And then you've got the same thing in chapter 15 and verse 6. It says, much wealth is in the house of the righteous, but trouble is in the income of the wicked. And that term is used consistently for the dishonest gains of the unrighteous. It cannot supersede one's moral needs. And now fourth and last on this point, how the righteous views money. It cannot create a happy home. It cannot create a happy home. A little line I read somewhere, and it's comes along with this, is that you marry poor, you divorce rich. And that many times is the case, that the increase of income seems to be standing side by side with we don't have any financial needs, and yet we're getting a divorce. And so chapter 17 and verse 1, better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. And so the picture is the house is full of an abundant amount of feasting and material wealth, but there's strife. It would be much better to have an old dry piece of bread and everybody in harmony. And anyone who has seen this type of thing knows, wouldn't it be nice, even though you're able at this point in life to put on a great feast, wouldn't it be much greater if everybody had a piece of bread and butter and everybody was getting along? Wouldn't that be nicer? And the emphasis is it cannot create a happy home. So then, how do the righteous view money? Number one point, it cannot meet his spiritual needs, nor his emotional needs, nor can it view, take care of his last one. Can it create a happy home? And now second, first of all, the righteous understands the fact that it cannot meet his spiritual needs. And now B, how he views it. The righteous understand the fleeting nature of money. The righteous understand its fleeting nature. Really, we should have put those first three under a different heading to parallel this. Basically, the first thing he's saying, he recognizes the limitations of money. Can't meet spiritual needs. It cannot meet emotional needs. It cannot supersede moral values. It cannot create a happy home. Those are under the umbrella of he understands its limitations. Now he understands its fleeting nature. How quickly it passes. Proverbs 23, verses 4 and 5. Now basically, Proverbs 23, verses 1 through 8 form a little unit. And the unit that is formed in Proverbs 23, 1 through 8 is the man Solomon is backing off and he is viewing what we might call the discomforts of social heights. Now there's nothing wrong with social prominence. But he's simply saying if you get in a position of social prominence, there are certain discomforts that go along with it. And in these eight verses, he is discussing it. And one of the first one is in verses 4 and 5, which says, do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. When you set your eyes on it, and here's how the righteous view money, it's gone. Does money fly? Does money tend to slip through your fingers? Does it tend to be transient? For wealth certainly makes itself wings. Do you ever have an idea that your bank account sprouts wings and flies away? You ever go to the grocery store and you go out and you're amazed at what you spent, or get your car repaired and you gasp at what just happened to you? Well, that's because wealth has a nature to it. It sprouts wings. And so if you think of a dollar bill, look at that thing and think of it as having two little wings on the side. And keep that in your mind. Money flies. Wealth certainly makes itself wings, like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. Now, we want to develop that in a little bit of detail, but our time is out. We'll pick up with it next hour, is how the righteous understand the fleeting nature of money. Our Father, we're thankful for your word today. We pray that we might gain wisdom from it in Christ's name. Amen.